The viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this Friday, and that means you're now listening to Literature with Lee and PT. Now today, PT, you've selected some pieces that are quintessentially American.
Oh, are they ever? And if you're talking quintessentially American, the first person I think of anyway is Mark Twain.
Mark Twain, absolutely. Now, of course, he was not born Mark Twain
in
all of the senses of that statement.
He was born Samuel Clemens.
That's right.
He was born in the center of the country, in Missouri,
but he had
the opportunity to travel both to the East Coast and to the West Coast, and lived in New England for a while and lived in New York for a while. So he pretty much covers a whole lot of the country.
Right. And not just the country, but he lived all over the world.
That too.
Right?
He at least visited all
at least
over
visited.
The world.
Yeah, you're absolutely. At least visited. I have a little excerpt here from a Salon article back from November 1st, 2017 by Lewis Lapham. And he points out that Twain traveled 49 times across the Atlantic and once across the Indian Ocean. He also was a tourist and saw Rome, Paris, and the Holy Land, and even entertained crowds in Australia. So, yeah, so he really was a world traveler, a very cosmopolitan man, as well as being a very down-to-earth person as well, right?
Down to earth.
Well, maybe not down to earth.
He was certainly down to earth, but his down to earthness was part of being a contrarian.
Yes.
He would figure out what people were thinking, and he would give air to the opposite. And,
yes.
And sometimes he would do that when there was a whole lot of feeling for one side or another.
Right. Now, Peter, you mentioned that he was from the middle of the country, and that's how I think of Twain, too. But in prepping for the selections that you picked for this week, and we'll get to those here in a bit, I was reading some articles, reading some background material that talked about how, you know, Twain was really a Western frontier man. And I was thinking, Western frontier? That makes no sense. Until, of course, you think about it in the context of his time. Being born in Hannibal, Missouri, and growing up in Hannibal, Missouri, I think he was actually born in a nearby town in Missouri.
Right.
That was the western edge of the United States.
It was, and then he one of his earlier jobs was on a riverboat,
which took
him to all sorts of different places up and down the Mississippi. And his first story that broke big was The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County.
Aha.
And Calaveras County is in California.
I would say nowhere near Missouri.
That's about as western edge as you can get.
Yeah, that's right. And he did spend some time. So his older brother, Orion, was named the Secretary of the Nevada Territory by Lincoln at one point in time. And his brother named him, Mark Twain, the Assistant Secretary. He did that for a little while, although I think there wasn't enough writing or excitement for him there. So I don't know how long he spent in that role.
He spent a lot of his time doing various different things in various different places as the mood struck him.
Right, right. Now, you also mentioned a bit earlier that by about the 1870s, Twain comes back to the East Coast.
He does. If you're talking 1870, at that point he's living in New York.
Okay.
Although he spent quite a few years in the Hartford, Connecticut area.
Yes, absolutely. He built a house in
Connecticut.
He did. Yes.
And it's still a great tourist attraction. And if you've ever been in Hartford, Connecticut, you pay attention to tourist attractions there because there's lots of things that aren't. Anyway, in 1870, he was living in New York. He was doing all sorts of writing. He was writing his books. He was writing magazine articles. He was doing all sorts of things.
Right.
And if you will permit me to kick this off.
Yeah, actually, PT, right before you do that, one of the other things I want to interject here, I found it interesting. I don't know if our listeners will. You know, growing up, especially here in the United States, of course you read Twain. When you think of great American literature, how could you not think of Twain? But during Twain's day and age, he actually struggled a little bit to be accepted as serious literature by sort of the purveyors of serious literature on the East Coast.
Oh, this is absolutely true, precisely because he had been in the West, had grown up in the West.
Absolutely.
Wasn't that familiar with anything.
Right.
East of the Mississippi
right.
River.
So between that and also he was a humorist, and you know we think of him as a satirist, which of course is what he really is, as well as a humorist. And I guess he was having a hard time being accepted by I'm reading an article here by John H. Davis from the Mark Twain Annual 2012 called "The Scent of a Satire: Validating the Invalid Story," and we'll talk about scents here in just a second. But the author John Davis mentions that that the standard bearing group of Down Easterners, basically holding up the literary establishment in the East, only half jokingly called Brahmins, really kind of hesitated to accept Twain.
They did. If you look at American humor before Twain, you see an awful lot of what I'd call Artemus Ward type stuff.
Okay.
It's humor based on backcountry pronunciation and people who aren't quite intellectual making bad jokes, corny stuff, that sort of thing.
Right. And
Twain approached it from a whole different angle. He was making the people real. They're still rural, but they have thoughts that are worthy of other people looking at, and that was something new at that time.
Absolutely. Now, from that same article, Henry Nash Smith says that the usual assumption that at that time was that there was no merger possible between serious literature and humor. I believe Twain later comes to say the secret source of humor itself is not joy but sorrow. There is no humor in heaven. And the pieces that we're going to talk about today, I think, touch upon all of these things. They're some of his more darker pieces, and his humor tended to turn quite a bit darker as he got older.
They did. I don't think any of the pieces we're going to talk about here are real late.
Well,
but he got very dark as he aged. You're right.
Right. Well, so actually, so we're going to actually start talking about Smells, which was 1870, I believe.
Right.
But our second piece, which we'll get to here in a bit, is The War Prayer, and that was written in 1905.
Oh, so, was it?
Yeah. I didn't so he was born was in 1835. Late. I believe he passed away in 1910. So
yeah.
The War Prayer was very late in his life and also was not published while he was living, and we'll talk more about that. but let's talk about Smells.
Let's. This one was kind of a softball for him. I think the biggest thing is at this point he was working for a magazine called The Galaxy.
Yes.
And The Galaxy was a really interesting magazine that was started by the Church Brothers, who had previously been Civil War correspondents. They published it for 2 years, and then they sold it to Sheldon and Company, who was more known for children's books.
Oh, interesting.
But that's okay.
Okay.
The Galaxy was a successful magazine. It brought Henry James to light. It brought Twain to light. It brought Walt Whitman to light.
Right.
And they paid him the magnificent sum of $20 a week for a weekly column, which at that time
was pretty darn
big
good.
Money.
Let me tell you something. Not too long ago, I was making $35 a column. So,
well, the reference I saw said that was about a little more than twice what a normal columnist would
Interesting.
Make.
Okay. And Twain wrote quite a number of stories for the Galaxy.
He did. They were all, they are not as immortal as Huckleberry Finn.
Right.
They dealt with current events, and this one did too. He found an article in a magazine called The Independent. It had been written by the Reverend T. DeWitt Talmage of Brooklyn. And I think I ought to read the entire quote because it gives you an idea of what Twain is going to write
about. Responding. Now, this is the quote from Talmage. Yes. Okay, go ahead, P.T.
Talmage says, "I have a good Christian friend who, if he sat in the front pew in church and a working man should enter the door on the other end, would smell him instantly. My friend is not to be blamed for his sensitivity of his nose any more than you would flog a pointer for being keener on the scent than a stupid watchdog. The fact is, if you had all churches free, by reason of mixing up the common people with the uncommon, you would keep one half of Christendom sick to their stomach. If you are going to kill the church thus with bad smells, I will have nothing to do with this work of evangelization." And I think anybody with even a half a modern mind can come up with a response to that.
And of course,
and
Twain had
certainly did.
More than half of a modern mind back then and now.
I kind of bristle at flog a pointer for being keener on the scent than a stupid watchdog. I've never seen a stupid watchdog.
I have not either. Well, but you know, Talmage is commenting on one of his good Christian friend. Of course, Mark Twain, in Mark Twain's very Twain-esque way, responds to Talmage.
Almost instantly crushes him.
Yes.
We have reason to believe that there will be laboring men in heaven, and also a number of Negroes and Eskimos and Tierra del Fuegans and Arabs, and a few Indians, and possibly even some Spaniards and Portuguese. And he just takes it on. It's
absolutely all things are possible with God.
Yes.
Right. We shall have all these sorts of people in heaven. But alas, in getting them, we shall lose the society of Dr. Talmage, which is to say, we shall lose the company of one who could give more real tone to celestial society than any other contribution Brooklyn could furnish. And what would eternal happiness be without the doctor? Blissful. Unquestionably. And it continues.
Yes. Because Brooklyn has had a very up and down reputation over the years, I wonder what Brooklyn's reputation was at this time. I don't know.
I don't know either. But of course, you know, one of the points that Twain is making in here, further down in the piece, and it's a very fairly short piece, when we think about Jesus as a person, and Jesus that we know him through the New Testament and the Bible. Well, how did Jesus start out? He was a carpenter.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, if there aren't laboring men in heaven, we have a problem here.
We do.
The other interesting thing that I found, P.T., and this is, again, I pulled from John H. Davis's The Scent of a Satire. Davis is really, in his article, he's talking about another one of Twain's stories called The Invalid Story, but he does mention this about smells. Apparently, Twain actually has several stories that relate to smells in which he's making very similar points, right? And of course, Mark Twain, of course, typically, and I'm quoting John Davis here, typically scorning and satirizing class consciousness, Victorian hypersensitivity, genteel hypocrisy, religious exclusiveness, and narrow viewpoints.
Yes, and all that was very typical of Twain. A little subtlety, too. As you go into the article, he talks about the Reverend Talmage's friend. He puts friend in quotes.
Right.
Because it's obvious to him that the Reverend Talmage is probably talking about
right.
the Reverend Talmage.
Right. So, as we would say today, I have a friend
who has
a question about
my
something.
My friend wants
right.
to know
the,
about that.
The other thing that our listeners can't see until they actually pull up the piece, Twain starts referring to him in the very first line, Reverend T. DeWitt Talmage of Brooklyn. And then later you get Dr. Talmage. By the end of the piece, he's calling him Mr. T. So he's really...
What a great name. Do you think we could find a name like that for an actor or something?
Right, right. So Davis's article talking about pieces, you know, part of Twain's writings, like about smells, The Undertaker's Tale, The Invalid's Story. The Invalid's Story is actually set on a train that's traveling through this blizzard. And there's this odor that's being emitted in the train that they think is coming from a coffin, because a gentleman is taking a friend of his who has died, you know, back to his family to be buried. But it's actually the body's not in the coffin. It got sort of switched up, and it's a crate of rifles, and somebody left some Limburger cheese.
Oh.
And so that's what what's emitting the smell. And on the one hand, you think, aha, this is a little silly and a little ludicrous, but Twain is actually playing with smells and rifles and death and odors and religion and social status, mixing it all into one, right? I'm quoting John Davis here. Where cheese, sustenance, emits odor linked to death, ironically linking life and death, as a town associated with new life, because they're traveling to Bethlehem, receives a box thought to bear a corpse containing fresh instruments of death's rifles. So you can see the genius in Twain's satirization and his dark humor.
Absolutely.
Right. And John Davis sums this up, all of these stories, including about smells. These earlier works tell readers that lower class people emit odors, that bodies decay, that upper class people also emit odors but savor their own, that access to church and heaven may be limited to those who do not reek of labor or other lifestyles, and that humor about death, signified by olfaction, depends on one's point of view. And Twain, of course, here is giving us some instruction, I think, about our points of view.
Absolutely. As you mentioned, his era, the middle and late Victorian era, was famous for a certain amount of classism.
That's right.
Was famous for people imagining that they were better people for being hypersensitive and neurotic and the rest of it.
Right.
And somebody like Twain was absolutely necessary to keep all that together.
Right. And I love Twain's subtleties that he plays with language, even in the middle of things that aren't so subtle. We were just mentioning how he reduces the Reverend or Dr. Talmage down to just Mr. T. Davis points out that the title for the invalid's story actually could be read as the invalid's story, or the things we do in society to invalidate other members of society.
Oh, this is true. This is true. I suspect that's analytical on his part rather than any intent of Twain's. But
possibly, but I wouldn't put it past Twain if you really want to know the truth. I think he was playing around this.
It would be possible, but... Twain is famous for his disdain for people who did autopsies on his writing.
Well, this is pretty much what he has to live with now, right?
Yeah.
He
wouldn't enjoy this at all.
No, he would not enjoy this at all. In that same article, Davis quotes Twain as saying, "Humor must not professedly teach or preach, but must do both if it would live forever." And I think that sums up.
I think that is true. Just a little sidelight here, Lee. The people who started Galaxy Magazine, WCNFP Church.
Okay.
After they sold the magazine, they went on to various different editorial and writing jobs in New York. Did that for most of their life, but FP Church wrote a very famous editorial himself called Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus.
That's right. I think many people might have heard of that if they haven't.
I think they, yeah, right. Well, yes.
And also eventually about 10 years in, the Galaxy ends up being, it becomes the Atlantic Monthly.
Well, it gets trend.
It gets absorbed by the
absorbed,
Atlantic.
Absorbed, yeah. The Atlantic picks it up essentially. There was a good deal of mergers and friendly mergers and unfriendly mergers. And who can say?
But it
does become the Atlantic. As a matter of fact, I found some source material on the Atlantic website.
Okay. Can you tell us a little more about that?
How about that's number three?
Oh, that's number three.
Yes.
Well, all right. Well, so we have about 5 minutes before, I guess, what is called the bottom of the hour. I just learned that from Brian Renner last week. And we'll take a brief break for station identification and a few announcements. So we have about 4 minutes before we want to pause here, PT.
Okay. I think this would be a good time to introduce then the war prayer.
The second story, absolutely. Now, many people might know the war prayer.
It's a familiar story. There was a book written about Twain's more aggressive stuff way back called A Pen Warmed Up in Hell.
That's very fitting for Twain.
That was taken from some of his writings, I believe.
Right. And I don't think we told our listeners that today our three selections are, we've related them to, you could call it Angry Twain
or Darker Twain. Yeah.
Okay.
And as you pointed out, this one was written late in life when he was painting in darker colors anyway.
Anyway, absolutely. His humor definitely tended to turn much, much darker as he got older. And in part, and this is from that Salon article I was talking about earlier that also has some excerpts from a book called Mark Twain's America by Harry Katz in the Library of Congress, So I'm quoting Lewis Lapham here. Twain's comedy drifts toward the darker shore of tragedy as he grows older and loses much of his liking for what he comes to regard as, quote, the damned human race. Lapham continues, Twain doesn't absent himself from the company of the damned. He knows himself made, like all other men, as, quote, a poor, cheap, wormy thing, a sarcasm, the creator's prime miscarriage in invention, the moral inferior of all the animals, the superior to them in one gift only, and that one not up to his estimation of it, intellect. So you can see Twain's state of mind when he's writing something like the War Prayer.
I think it became fashionable, even copied. If you look at the late Twain, some of the things you see from Ambrose Bierce right around the same time is not that far off
right.
from what Twain is saying. The other thing, too, is in 1898, you have the Spanish-American War.
That's right.
Which was the first foreign war we'd fought in I don't know how long. And that upset a lot of the people who thought that we should just be sticking to developing our own countries, including some fairly influential people. I think some of that might have influenced
very
Twain.
Much so. And of course, by 1905, we have come through in our country the Gilded Age, which of course Twain is the one who nicknamed. And you know, this is around the height of the robber barons. The beginning of some progressive movements in early 20th century United States, America. What Twain was really talking about, and this is Lewis Lapham's thinking here and writing here, Twain was really writing about throughout his life America and the Americans making their 19th century passage from an agrarian democracy to an industrial oligarchy. To Twain's mind, this is a great and tragic tale.
It is. Twain kept touch with the West, Missouri and further West. He was keenly aware of what some of the results of this industrialization were. You get the populist movement, the agrarian movement. You get a certain number of working man's movement.
Right.
He was in sympathy with an awful lot of
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. 1890, you get at Congress, you get the passage of the Sherman Antitrust Act. By the time we get Teddy Roosevelt in office, we're starting to look at conserving the environment, protecting consumers, controlling some corporations. Things are really changing right around this period. Where
they certainly are, and it's a very dramatic change from the the things that came before.
Right. On that note, PT, let's take a very quick break for station identification and a couple of announcements. And when we come back here on Listening to Literature, let's actually dig into the war prayer and see what it's all about.
Okay.
This is WRUULP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul. Support for this portion of WRUULP, Savannah Soundings programming, comes from our listeners and from the City of Savannah Sustainability Department, presenting the 20th Savannah Earth Day Festival on Saturday, April 18th, from 12 to 4 p.m. in Daffin Park. This year's festival will highlight local student work called Our Earth, Our Future, from the youth-led environmental movement. More information can be found at earthdaysavannah.org.
WRUU 107.5 FM is a new and different listener-supported and all-volunteer community radio station for Savannah. Our diverse broadcast and web programming is supported by generous listeners who value our passion and spunk. We are independent of other media and receive no government or large corporate support. People like you are the largest and most important source of our funding. Go to WRUU.org to find out how you can make a one-time or monthly contribution. Thank you.
Well, welcome back to Listening to Literature with Lee and PT. Today, PT and I are looking at a couple of short stories from Mark Twain in his darker years.
Or at least his darker moods.
His darker moods. And we just introduced right before the break a story that Poe wrote in 1905 called The War Prayer. Now, this was not published until after he had died. He was very afraid. Well, I think he might have been willing to publish it while he was alive, but he did still have a family. He was afraid of some of the backlash.
There were ample reasons to be concerned. The gist of the story is that it is at the beginning of a war and people have their patriotism up.
Right. In a fictional town.
In a fictional town, one would hope. I don't think he ever specifies.
No, he does not. But this hits home whether we're talking about a fictional town or a real town, a town from 1905 or a town from 2020, I think.
Right, yeah. Right. At any rate, they're in the middle of all this fervor, and a man comes and says, "I am the messenger of God."
Now, all of the people in this town, they are actually in a church. There's a minister up at the front of the church,
right.
And they are all praying together. They have all their young people who are sitting in the pews along with their families who are about ready to go off to war. And a lot of the first part of the war prayer is very beautiful language and beautiful writing, almost, you know, war as beautiful, right? So Sunday morning came. Next day, the battalions would leave for the front. The church was filled. The volunteers were there, their young faces alight with martial dreams, visions of the stern advance, the gathering momentum, the rushing charge, the flashing sabers, the flight of the foe, the tumult, the enveloping smoke, the fierce pursuit, the surrender. You can see, you know, how sort of beautiful he's making war seem. And all of the people who are at this church are praying. What are they praying for? Of course, they're praying for victory, right? The volunteers who sat with their dear ones, proud, happy, and envied by the neighbors and friends who had no sons and brothers to send forth to the field of honor, there to win for the flag or, failing, die the noblest of noble deaths, that either way it's victory, right?
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And so, and then like you said.
Then he goes through and translates all of these things for them.
This aged stranger who shows up.
Right.
Right. And who basically comes up and says, let me give our listeners, I love the description that that Twain gives of this aged stranger, entered and moved with a slow and noiseless step up to the main aisle, his eyes fixed upon the minister, his long body clothed in a robe that reached to his feet, his head bare, his white hair descending in a frothy cataract to his shoulders, his seamy face unnaturally pale, pale even to ghastliness. And this minister, I'm sorry, this stranger, who kind of interrupts the minister in everybody's prayers, it says more or less, well, yes, you know, you are praying and you have said one part of your prayer out loud, but you fail to sort of voice the second part of your prayer.
You have heard your servant's prayer, the uttered part of it. I am commissioned by God to put into words the other part of it, the part which the pastor and also you in your hearts fervently prayed silently and ignorantly and unthinkingly. God grant that it was so. And in a few lines, he goes into his version of the war prayer.
Right, and the unspoken part. That's right.
Interpreting what they're saying.
Right.
And I think this bears complete quotation.
Go right ahead, PT.
Yes. Lord, our Father, our young patriots, idols of our hearts, go forth into battle. Be thou near them. With them in spirit, we also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord our God, help us tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of guns with the shrieks of their wounded, writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out roofless with their little children to wander unfriended in the wastes of their desolated land in rags and thunder and hunger and thirst. Sports of the sun, flames in summer and icy winds, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for refuge of the grave and denied it. For our sakes who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with tears, stain the white blood with the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. We ask it in the spirit of love of him who is the source of love and who is ever faithful refuge and friend of all that are sore and beset, and seek his humble aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen.
Right.
And people, I think, understood the war prayer a whole lot more after the First World War.
Absolutely. I mean, our modern sense very much changed after World War I.
It did, and Twain was one of the people who was able to derive that sort of thing even from the Civil War.
Right.
And a lot of people did not.
Right.
But he is essentially foretelling the First World War here.
Right. And he's tapping into something that we don't tend to acknowledge with full consciousness, which is when we are praying for victory and calling for patriotism and things like that, concomitantly, we're also calling for our foes being smitten.
Well, if there's going to be a victory, smoked, there has to be a loser.
There has to be a loser.
And when you're talking war, the consequences of being a loser are fairly grim.
No, absolutely. Now, going back to that Salon article, Lewis Lapham, this is how he interprets things like the war prayer and a lot of Twain's later work. Humor is still the great thing, the saving thing after all. But as the gilded spirit of the age becomes everywhere more oppressive under the late 19th century chandeliers, Twain pits the force of his merciless and undiluted wit against the peacock shams of the world's colossal humbug. He doesn't traffic in the mockery of a cynic or the bitterness of a misanthrope, nor does he expect his ridicule to correct the conduct of Boss Tweed, improve the morals of Commodore Vanderbilt, or stop the same-day deliveries of the politicians to the banks. His purpose is therapeutic. A man at play with the freedoms of his mind, believing that it is allegiance to the truth and not the flag that rescues the citizens of a democracy from the prisons of their selfishness and greed. I think that statement right there is something that we could attend to today, too, right?
Allegiance to the truth. I think it is. I'm not sure with what success, but that would be nice.
But and so for me, looking at the war prayer through this lens of Twain's purpose being therapeutic, you can see how he's using his humor and his satire to get us to think a little deeper about who we are as humans and how we act. And, you know, maybe it won't correct all the ills of our world or all the ills of our actions, but maybe there can be some therapy in there.
Perhaps.
I might be a little more hopeful.
Again, to me, at this point, Twain had stopped being a humorist. He was trying to tell people something important.
Something very important. And of course, and this is a very short story, The War Prayer, the very end of the story, after the stranger who has arrived at this church, you know, has shared this insight with all the churchgoers, everything is sort of silent and he's sort of waiting. He's waiting for them to speak. And the last line is, it was believed afterward that the man was a lunatic because there was no sense in what he said. So this stranger gets brushed aside as someone who's inconsequential, and his thoughts and his insights are inconsequential. Let's move forward with our war.
And this is something that this is a piece of machinery, a mechanism that Twain goes back and uses from time to time in all of his shorter works.
Absolutely. Now, P.T., I have to add, as a kind of a weird side note, and I know I'm excited about this. I don't know if you will be or any of our listeners will be, but there have been many sort of films or TV shows or song that based off of The War Prayer. And there is one, I'm trying to find my notes here, so works based on this short story. In 2007, there was a short film based on Twain's piece that featured as the minister Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And I didn't dig too deep. I'm assuming that's, you know, one of my favorite poets there. And Lawrence Ferlinghetti in 2007 is pretty up there in age.
Yeah. Well, he just turned 100, so do the math.
Right. I know. I think he's even beyond that now, I think. We'll have to go back there. So anyway, this work, like most of Twain's work, of course, still resonates with us today. And I think this is a very important piece. And like you said, Twain is trying to send a different message.
I think it does, and I think the reason that it resonates with us today is the things he saw back in his day, some of them are still with us, only more so.
Right.
And so some of his contrarianism seems even more appropriate now than it did back in his day.
Now, The War Prayer finally saw print in 1923, and of course, in a very Twain-esque way. Twain, at one point, you know, when he was asked if he was going to publish it, regardless of what anybody thought while he was alive, he said, "No, I have told the whole truth in that, and only dead men can tell the truth in this world. It can be published after I am dead," and indeed, it was. Now, P.T., a little while ago, you had mentioned Twain in relation to the Civil War. The Civil War, of course, very much affected Twain, just like it affected all Americans at that time. Our third piece.
It did, but perhaps Twain and the people in Twain's area, because they were kind of on the border between North and South, and had had some trouble making up their minds. This is yet another one of those awkward situations where you see two choices, neither of which you care for much, but you are forced to make up your mind to do one thing or another.
Now, Twain was part of a Confederate militia very, very briefly.
Yes, he joined. if you read his account of it, he joined with a certain number of reservations and developed even more reservations from the moment he joined them and wound up parting company with them.
Yes, absolutely.
But Twain also was able to see some of the ugliness of the war, because there was a good deal of what you might call guerrilla warfare in Missouri, in Kansas, in those areas that he was most familiar with.
Right. I know, you know, growing up in school, or when we think about the Civil War, you know, oftentimes we focused on the North and the South and the campaigns sort of on the eastern part of our country. But the war very much was going on and was affecting the western parts of our country,
it
too.
Absolutely was. And in the West, it got further complicated because the warriors there were not necessarily empaneled by either country as part of the army. This was citizen warfare. This was guerrilla groups. This right. was irregulars.
Right, absolutely. Now, Peachy, the third story you picked was, I believe, originally published in 1874. So we're backtracking a bit here.
Yes, and this one. It did appear in the Atlantic on their website, is where I found it.
Aha, uh-huh, yes. It, but not in 1874.
But not in 1874.
That's right.
So somewhat later.
Right. So published in 1874. So, you know, this, you know, Twain is going to be about, you know, he's almost 40 at this point. Of course, it is, you know, 10 years after the end of the Civil War. And this is called A True Story, repeated word for word as I heard it. Like the war prayer, this story has quite a bit to teach us about ourselves, doesn't it?
It does. And again, I think one of the charms of Twain is in 1874, he's got a very 21st century attitude toward things, and that helps us appreciate him that much more.
Absolutely. Now, this story is set in summertime and twilight. We were sitting on the porch of the farmhouse on the summit of the hill, and Aunt Rachel was sitting respectfully below our level on the steps. Right, but he has Aunt Rachel in quotation marks. Why is that, P.T.?
Well, he goes on and says
that's right.
She is a servant and she is black.
That's right. Now, I had read a few things, P.T., in preparing for this show, that Aunt Rachel, the character in this story, is actually based on a real woman, a woman by the name of Mary Ann Cord. I'm pulling this from a book called Writing America by Shelley Fisher Fishkin. And Fishkin says that Mary Ann Cord was a cook in the household of Twain's in-laws in New York. And Mary Ann Cord had been born into slavery in Maryland. Of course, by the time she's a cook in the household in New York, she is a free woman. Is this a true story, repeated word for word, as he heard it, P.T.?
It might well be.
It might well be.
It might well be.
Right. And the majority of the story, so this leads in the unnamed narrator and whoever else the narrator is sitting with are watching, you know, their Aunt Rachel, in quotation marks. She was of mighty frame and stature. She was 60 years old, but her eye was undimmed and her strength unabated. She was a cheerful, hearty soul, and it was no more trouble for her to laugh than it is for a bird to sing. And so this unnamed narrator, Mr. C., basically says, you know, hey, Aunt Rachel, you know, how is it that you've lived 60 years and never had any trouble? And of course, the rest of the short story is Aunt Rachel's response to this.
Yes. And it should be obvious to everybody that somebody with Aunt Rachel's background has had a whole lot of trouble.
A whole lot of trouble.
And she goes through it from growing up a slave to the master and mistress of the house becoming so impoverished that they can no longer keep slaves, to being put on the slave block.
In Richmond.
In Richmond, mm-hmm. Having her husband sold and her children sold and herself being sold all to different places.
Right. Now, she and her husband had seven children together.
Right.
She, like I said, the rest of the story is Aunt Rachel telling her own tale in her own words, and the description of what it was like to be put in chains and put up on a stand as high as the porch, 20 foot high, with all the people standing around, crowds and crowds, being on the auction block. It's harrowing, as you know, absolutely, you know, the way she describes it, and especially losing her husband, and then, of course, losing her children one by one. And one of her children, I think the littlest one, Henry, she actually attempts to save him.
She does, but to no avail.
To no avail. But here she says, "But my little Henry whisper and say, I'm going to run away, and then I'm going to work to buy your freedom." And of course, you know, he's so young and he gets taken away from her. And then she tells the rest of her tale. By the time, about the middle of the story, maybe, it's been 22 years later. And she was finally, she's now a cook amidst Union soldiers. Is that correct, PT?
That is true. This is something that she takes on. But what's interesting about it to me is that she carries on some of her old traditions from her family. At the time she was sold, she's in Virginia, but she was raised in Maryland.
That's right.
And so was her mother before her. And her mother, when she was excited, would say, "I want you to understand that I wasn't born into MASH to be fooled by trash. I was one of the old blue hen's chickens, I is. Because, you see, that's what people that's born in Maryland call themselves, and they're proud of it." And just as a sidelight, what's interesting to me, nowadays, one associates the blue hen with Delaware, not Maryland.
That's
but it was all part of the same thing, I suppose, back then.
Absolutely.
And her mother used to say that, and she takes it up whenever she's excited. She'll come right out with those same words,
right. And that becomes an essential part of the story.
Right.
Right. Now, the majority of the story, again, it's her story, her narrative in her words. And so Twain writes this using her dialect.
He does.
And his intention for doing this, I think, obviously, is to give voice to her, to let her tell her own story, particularly at a time, I mean, you know, even in 2020, we have a hard time hearing certain people's stories and let them speak for themselves.
Right. Twain could have obviously put this in sterling English. He could have put some of his own literary flourishes into it. He chose to record it, if you will, at least somewhat like she was telling it, and probably straight.
Right. Word for word is what he says in the title.
Yeah, he says word for word.
Right.
And it gives it a certain emotion and eloquence that it probably wouldn't have had if he had changed it around.
Right. Now, at one point in time, these new Union officers, you know, she's free now. She's working for these Union officers as their cook. And it's something that she does love doing. She loves cooking. She starts talking with them about you know, not having seen her children for so many years. And she starts talking with them about young Henry. And she asks, hey, you know, he was supposed to escape. She finds out that he did run off to the north and became free, became a barber. Mm-hmm. But then he decided, you know what, he was going to fight for the Union cause. But I think one of the most touching parts of this for me is when the Union soldiers, you know, tell her, well, yeah, but you can't think of him as a little boy anymore. He's now a man.
Yeah.
And this is a very difficult realization that she has lost not only her family and her children, but also all of those years of seeing them grow up.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. What's important to her, of course, is the possibility of seeing any of them again. And she's been so intent on this from that angle that she's never considered the possibility that he might have be a man now.
Right. And she actually says, he was only that little feller to me. All right. She never thought about him growing up and being big. But then she starts to see it, you know. And so we can let our listeners maybe read the rest of that story. That is still important today as it was back when Twain wrote it. I think one of the interesting things as well about this story, PT, is that when you're reading this story, since you know it's from Twain, you're kind of waiting for the, okay, where's the twist? Where's the, you know, where's the humor that he's going to throw at you at the end? And obviously this story does not have that humor. There is a bit of a twist, but it's not humor.
There is a twist at the end, mm-hmm. But the story is at least superficially set up to counter the idea that she's never had any trouble in her life.
Right, absolutely.
And right. It certainly does that.
Right, absolutely. Do you think he took some creative, artistic license with parts of her story?
If he did, it's invisible enough that it doesn't make any difference.
Right, right.
To me, anyway.
Well, and that's one of the things I'm really interested in, the concept of narrative. And, of course, that's what narrative does. Narrative always, you know, changes certain things. And, of course, so we're getting her narrative through Twain. And, of course, it is filtered through him. So even though Twain was a humorist and a satirist, he realized, like, I think I mentioned at the top of the hour, about that, you know, really, where does this come from? It comes from sorrow, not from joy.
It does come from sorrow in all three cases.
Right.
You have this person who's so refined he can smell a working man from 100 feet.
Right.
And you have this odd preacher who comes in and tells people what they're really thinking.
Right.
And now you have Aunt Rachel,
who's really telling not only her story, but the story of so many others who suffered during slavery.
Right.
Right, absolutely.
And there's a measure of sorrow. A big measure of sorrow in all of them.
In all of them. Now, Twain once said, the hard and sordid things in life are too hard and too sordid and too cruel for us to know and touch them year after year without some mitigating influence. And for him, that mitigating influence, I think in part, is the satire, or is the humor, or maybe it's some sarcasm, some parody.
It is, and what you find is people's senses of humor are often created by how close they get to those sad things. You will find out that ambulance drivers and policemen and firemen and nurses have their own unique sense of humor, which may not be the same as people who work outside the field. Matter of fact, may be offensive to people who work outside the field. But they deal with the things they deal with, so that sense of humor is very important to them.
Absolutely, and that really speaks to a lot of the Twain stories we've talked about today. So, PT, we are already at the end of our hour. So, PT and I really want to thank you for listening to Literature with us today here on WRUU 107.5 FM. Good day and good reading. The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. This is WRUU LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.